Our main speaker tonight is Bill.
My name is Bill, and my body has alcoholism. I'd like to start by asking for a moment of silence. And during these next few seconds, I'd like you to think about one thing. Where would you be tonight if there was no such thing as Alcoholics Anonymous? Thank you. I thought I'd start with a dose of gratitude. I know I'd be dead if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to ask my higher power to put the words in my mouth, to put love in my heart, and to help me speak the truth. And I always promised myself that if I ever spoke at a big meeting, I would do this, so please forgive me. If you're 13th stepping, please stop. Listen, we know who you are. If your group is not willing to say something, I will be willing to stand up and say, please, if you're 13 stepping, please stop. Thank you. Where to begin? I remember my first drink. I was 13. I remember my first blackout. It was my 18th birthday. Which is sort of like a contradiction of terms, you know, remembering your first blackout. I didn't really drink much after 13, but then by 16 it was monthly, by 17 it was weekly, by 18 it was daily, and, you know, when I was 18 I went to this party, and when I was 30 I came home from that party. That's pretty much what it was like. It's interesting. I want to thank the two 10-minute speakers. I identified with a lot of that. It's interesting. Both of them mentioned the inside stuff. You know what I mean? I came from a very religious family. I came from a very wonderful family. I came from a very loving family. I came from a very supportive family. But I didn't love myself, and I didn't support myself, so all of that meant nothing to me. Next thing I know, I decided to go to Florida for college and you know, forget about it. You know, that was the first time I ever left home, and it was just, you know, you were drunk before you brushed your teeth. You know what I mean? You know, you drank before class, during class, after class, you know, all night, Johnny Carson monologue, and then go to the close the bar. You know, just constant. You know, the first year I was at college, I went to class every day. The second year I went to college, I didn't go to class every day. By the time my second year was over, I was basically asked not to return. I come back to New York, and my family's like, who's this guy? This isn't the son who left home 2 years ago. And I was staying with them during the summer, but there was such a drastic transition of my whole personality. All of a sudden, I was abusive. All of a sudden, I was unpredictable. All of a sudden, it was ugly. You know, this thing was living in their house. I remember my first AA meeting. It was in Elmsford, New York, on White Plains Road. It was either below a bank or below a church or below an office, something over there. And a friend of mine asked me to go to a meeting with him because he wanted some support because his parents told him he had to go. So we partied on the way to the meeting, and, you know, here I am at an AA meeting. And it was kind of interesting because my first impression of the very first meeting I went to, I wasn't there because I thought I needed to be. I went there to support somebody. And my very first impression of an AA meeting was that you drink way too much coffee and you smoke way too many cigarettes, but you tell the coolest stories. I remember the guy who spoke that night. He was a major IBM executive. He told this story of his wife had left. He had this huge home. He had no problems paying for it. He didn't like doing laundry. But he had so much money that he would just buy new clothes. And he would take his old clothes, he'd wear them once or twice or three times. He would open this door, throw it into this room, and he would just not go into that room besides that. years later, he got sober, and somebody said to him, you know, what's going on with that room? And, you know, he had to go in there, and there's this big pile of clothes. And I was like, this guy is my hero. I don't like doing laundry either. I wish I had thought of that. True story. That's the only thing I remember about that meeting. It's the only thing. You know, the family is a little disgusted with me. Like I said, I come from a loving, incredibly beautiful family. I come from the Brady Bunch, and I'm not saying that to make a joke. My family literally is the Brady Bunch. I'm not kidding. I have never once heard either one of my parents curse. Never once. I'm not kidding. These are incredibly wonderful people that live their religion and live God living through them. They're just the most wonderful people, but they were so annoying. I couldn't, you know, you can't relate to it. You can't live up to it. So what do you do then? You know what I mean? I've talked with people who, you know, kind of had not very many positive role models. Well, guess what? I lived with constant role models. It drove me nuts. I left New York and I moved to New Jersey. I was like, screw this. You know what I mean? Like, I can't live this way. I can't do it. I can't do it. So, you know, some of you might be thinking, you know, if only I was white, or if only my parents made more money, or if only my family was more supportive. I had all that. It made no difference whatsoever. So I got a hostage and moved to New Jersey and got married, and she said something to me one day. It's funny, I remembered it the other day. I had totally forgotten about it, but my first ex-wife, all my ex-wives, I still talk to every once in a while. I have three ex-wives, and I'm currently not married. And I'm not sure why that's funny. And my first ex-wife said to me one day, she's like, you can't even go out without a buzz, can you? And I remember thinking, what's the big deal? Like, you know, what's the point? You know, why is that so bad? What's wrong about that? You know, by that point, it was just, you know, you just can't go out. I mean, there's people out there, you know. You gotta lubricate, you know. And then it got to the point where, you know, she was very close with her family, and she wanted to go visit the family. And after a while, it's like, you know, go visit the family, because then I can drink. You know what I mean? Because you're cramping my style. You know, it was my first relationship ever. It was the first time I ever had sex. I figured, you know, I had sex. I married her. I figured that was it, you know. Because I come from the Brady Bunch. They don't get unmarried, you know what I mean? And you know, that didn't work out. And now I'm stuck with all these emotions, you know what I mean? I'm stuck with all these emotions. I'm stuck with this turmoil. I'm stuck with a family that can't relate to me because they've never gotten unmarried. So what's wrong with Bill, you know what I mean? Not like they didn't know, but, you know, who do I, you know, all my friends partied, all my friends were like, you know, good, now you can drink more, you know. I tried to talk to my family, but they couldn't relate, and, you know, what am I left with? You know, nothing. Well, I'm left with this hole. I'm left with this mind that just chews you up and spits you out, and you know, there's people out there, so you got to party, and then you go to work, and then, you know, you go to lunch, and then however long that takes, and then you come back to work, and you just somehow resonate toward jobs that allow you to do that, and, So I started working for AT&T, and, you know, you don't have a problem with drinking when you're, like, excelling at work, you know what I mean? So that was a little bit of a you know, life kind of was supporting me with my habits because I was doing really well at work. But, you know, you reach the point where, you know, you're not changing the oil in your car anymore because you don't even remember you're supposed to do that. I started delivering pizza, and everybody would just come down to the pizzeria, and, you know, Bill's a roving party, so... You know, let's go to the pizzeria and meet up with Bill. He's got a cooler filled with all kinds of stuff in the back of the car. And I used to love the winter time because then you don't have to get ice because, you know, it just stays cold all winter. And you know, you reach a point where you start to have these situations that you get yourself into. You know what I mean? Work's starting to kind of clamp down a little bit because you're only supposed to be taking 45 minutes for lunch and you're taking 2 hours. You know, you're coming in late and you're leaving early and you're starting to, you know, I discovered something that they should have never told me. It was their fault. It wasn't my fault. I discovered that if you call in sick on Friday and if you call in sick again on Monday, it's still considered to be one occurrence. So then you start calling in sick on Friday and then you party all weekend and then you have to sleep on Monday. So then you call in sick on Monday and it's still one occurrence, so it's not like, you know, double occurrence or whatever. And, you know, it just, you start having problems with the family, you start having problems with your friends, you start getting into accidents, and there's a line in the Big Book, there's many parts of the book that talk about what it was like for me, you know, what it was like in the beginning, you know, an exhilarating part of my life, and, you know, life took on new meaning and all that, and, you know, but there was, and then at the end, you know, just the blackouts and the craziness and the, you know, almost liking that you have no friends because, you know, they're just going to cramp your style and drink some of your booze anyway. But there's one part of the book that describes from start to finish what my drinking was like, and it's just four words, and that's the Big Book quiz. Find it. The four words are, gradually things got worse. That's it. That describes from start to finish, gradually things got worse. Maybe it wasn't quickly, but gradually or quickly, things got worse. And it was just crazy. So I find myself needing to get out of another situation, so I go to AA. And then when the situation goes away, I have no reason to be there, so I go back out. And then, you know, I needed to borrow money from the parents, so I went to AA, and then when I got the money out of them, then, you know, you stop going to meetings. And, you know, I wasn't there because I thought I had a problem. I was just there to get myself out of a situation. So I reached a point where it started to become really obvious that since I come from an incredibly loving family, and I cared for them, I mean, somewhere deep down inside, I cared for them. It wasn't a place where I was in touch with at all, but I cared for them, but I never acted that way. I had reached a point where I realized that, you know, if things continue the way they are, my mom's going to get a phone call saying I'm dead. And do you want to put yourself, you know, you want to put your mom through that? I mean, I remember that same year when I was having those thoughts, I forgot my mom's birthday. And I mean, I could rattle off every single family member's birthday right now. I have a really close family, and I forgot my mother's birthday. And, you know, it was like Saturday, and then like Monday or Tuesday, I kind of, you know, landed and went back to work and realized I had forgotten her birthday, and I called her up, and I was crying, and I was like, you know, I have a problem. And although I had done that before, she didn't realize it, but this time I really just saw that something's really wrong. And I started going to some meetings. You know, I started going to meetings. Unfortunately, I made the very large mistake that I always try to talk about whenever I tell my story or if I talk to new people, and that was that I made the mistake of believing that alcohol is my problem, so not drinking is my solution. But I didn't think I needed to do anything else because alcohol is my problem, so not drinking is my solution. And what happened was for 1 year and 3 weeks, I was stark raving sober. There was a story in the second edition of the Big Book, and it said that I was dry as dust and just as worthless. I love that line. That's another Big Book quiz. Find it in the second edition. I don't know which story it was, but that was an exact quote. I was as dry as dust and just as worthless. And that was what that year and 3 weeks was like. And it was suggested that I not get into a relationship, so of course that's the reason why I did. I don't know about anybody else, but, you know, I actually use that today to counter people. Like, you know, new people, they don't want to do what you ask them to do, so tell them not to do something, and then they're all willing to do it. You know what I mean? It's a whole counter ploy. But, you know, I was the kind of person, you tell them not to do it, that's why I do it, you know? So I got involved with this girl, and she actually was a wonderful lady, but, you know, I was just the insane, you know, monster that lived in the closet, you know? And then the relationship, you know, surprisingly ended, you know? And, you know, now I'm left with what? You know what I mean? I had all partying friends. I can't talk to them anymore because I just can't be around them. I can't talk to my family because they can't relate because they never break up with their current whatever. And so now I'm left with this hole. I'm left with nothing to deal with the emotional, psychological, spiritual, and mental aspects of alcoholism. So I went back. Because alcohol is the only thing that ever helped me with that condition. Alcohol is the only thing that quieted the voices. Alcohol is the only thing that ever minimized the fears. Alcohol is the only thing that got me to like where I was, doing what I was doing with whoever it was that I was with. Alcohol is the only thing that ever did that for me. And now I got, you know, a year and 3 weeks, and I have no tools for living. I have no tools for my emotions. I have no tools for life or you know, just dealing with whatever's going on. Because, you know, there's people out there, you know. So, you know, I got this hole in my gut, and there's only one thing to do, and that's drink. So I went back to it again for about 6 or 7 months, and I don't know about anybody else here, but pretty quickly it surpassed where I was the year earlier. You know, within a couple months, I was already partying worse than I was the year before when I had quit. And, you know, it just became real obvious that I was headed toward death. It was really obvious. I mean, I was doing, you know, it just becomes really obvious, you know what I mean? It's not a moment of clarity, it's a moment of obviousness, you know what I mean? I mean, everybody else knows. Like, why is it news to me, you know? So I went to my second and final rehab, which was Clearbrook in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. It's funny because every once in a while I run into somebody who went there, not necessarily with me, but that had also gone to that place. It was a really wonderful place. And I have to be honest with you, it was a wonderful place because of one thing, because I let it be a wonderful place. Because for the first time I saw that I had a problem and there was nothing I could do about it. So I went to this place, and, you know, you're kind of open-minded, you know what I mean? You're kind of, if they had told me to take off all my clothes and stand in the corner on my head for 10 minutes, and that'll keep me sober, I'm there, you know what I mean? I sat up front, I took notes, I cried, I talked about stuff I swore I would never tell anybody. You know, I shared about my first marriage and about the emotions around it. I shared about, you know, inadequacies of not being able to live up to the example that my family was giving me. You know, fears about work. It was a very cool experience, and only for one reason, and that's because I allowed it to be. So I get out, and, you know, they had given me some suggestions, but you see, I didn't take them as suggestions. I took them as, these are things I must do. These are things I must do. These are the things that the people who came before me that were successful did, so these are things that I must do. They're not suggestions as far as I'm concerned. They're as much of a suggestion as, you know, it's suggested that you pull the ripcord when you jump out of a plane with a parachute, you know what I mean? It's suggested that you pull the ripcord, you know? So, you know, now I find myself in AA again, and this time I found myself, I guess I had about 3.5 years, you know, made a lot of coffee and didn't drink any of it because I didn't drink coffee, put away a lot of ashtrays and didn't smoke, and put a lot of chairs away that I didn't sit on, and went to dances and conferences and a lot of meetings, and got a sponsor but didn't really use them. Like I said, you know, alcohol is my problem, so not drinking is my solution. I mean, I want to share one of my early ideas with you. For me, it's almost like a pet hobby of mine is listening to newcomers' early ideas, because, you know, there's some really classic ideas that people have. And one of my early ideas was that the steps are intellectually insulting and they just don't apply to me. I mean, they're really for, you know, that they're hardcore, you know, you know, I have an alcohol problem, so I don't drink. What's this stuff? What's this stuff? You know, I came from a religious family. This whole God thing is kind of a little bit on the spooky side, and it really doesn't apply to me. I see it working in my family's lives and other people, but what does that have anything to do with me, you know? I mean, I had dabbled in that stuff, but, you know, my concept of a higher power before I came to AA was, you know, whatever I was being told, you know, whatever my religion's concept of a higher power is, that's my concept of a higher power. Whatever my parents' concept of a higher power was, that's my concept of a higher power. I did not have my own, let alone a relationship with it. You know, I didn't even have a concept, let alone a relationship with it. And for me, you know, it's a concept is a good beginning. Belief and faith is a good beginning, but then it starts talking about conscious contact. It starts talking about a little bit more than just a concept. It starts talking about a relationship that's so important in my life today. And after 3.5 years, you know, I just found myself, once again, my mind is chewing me up and spitting me out. Once again, I got this hole. Once again, I got all this guilt or remorse. Once again, I'm just filled with fear and resentment, and they're not acting the way I think they should, and you know, just all of that. And I reached perhaps the single most important bottom that I ever hit. But you see, I had 3.5 years sober. In some terms, 3.5 years is relatively successful in AA. But that was when I really hit my bottom, because for the first time, my pain and turmoil and anxiety and all of that that I had going on, I couldn't blame alcohol for it anymore. The only thing I could blame was my best thinking and the way I was living my life. And for the very first time in my life, I did something that for me is the single most factor, the single most important factor when it comes to AA, and that's that I needed to consider another way besides my own. Now as far as I'm concerned, if you're new here, you know, we saw some people stand up, you're new. I don't wish you happiness. I don't wish you success. I don't wish you peace of mind. I wish you desperation. Because only if you are desperate are you going to be willing to do all that and all the things that we hear that are suggested in this program. And then after I do all that stuff, then I'm really going to experience that peace of mind. Then I'm really going to experience that true success. Then I'm really going to experience that contentment that is what I look for in a bottle my whole entire life. So after 3.5 years, I'm in this lost space. I might as well, I'm going to hurt somebody, I'm going to hurt myself, I'm going to kill myself, I'm going to drink. What is it? If this is what it's going to be like, this sucks. And then that was when I decided to consider another way besides my own. And that was when the student was ready and the teachers flooded in. And don't get me wrong, you know, maybe these people were around or whatever, but I never saw them and I never heard them, and all of a sudden they were just swallowing me up, because these people were hitting me with all kinds of stuff that I can't say that I really ever heard before, or at least if I heard it, I never brought it in. They started talking to me about a threefold disease of body, mind, and soul. And I'm thinking, you know, I have 3.5 years. Why is this news to me? I have 3.5 years. Why is this part of it like news to me, you know? I started learning about that AA solution to alcoholism had three parts. That I need to be involved in the fellowship, that I need to be involved in service, and I need to be involved in the working and the reworking of the 12 steps. And then when I was explained to me, I realized, you know what? I'm just going to meetings, and every once in a while I do service. No wonder why I'm so insane. Well, all I was dealing with was the physical part of alcoholism. I never dealt with the inner stuff. And why is it after 3.5 years, is this news to me? You see, I had gone to Big Book meetings, but the average Big Book meeting, if they include the stories, 3/4 of the book is stories. So if you show up at a Big Book meeting that does stories, 75% of the time they're on one of the stories and you haven't even heard about the program yet. And then I went to this Big Book study, which coincidentally was just a couple weeks after a conversation I had with somebody, and coincidentally he had a flyer for it, and coincidentally I started hearing about the real deal. And coincidentally, I started seeing what my real problem was. And for the first time, I saw that I was an alcoholic. I never really completely understood what that meant. That once I start drinking, I can't predict how much I'm going to drink. I have an allergy. I set off a craving where I don't know what's going to happen once I start drinking. I thought I was schizophrenic or something, you know what I mean? I never understood that. I never understood why, when my first ex-wife would say to me, Bill, you know, if you keep drinking like this, I'm going to leave you. And I would swear to the tips of my toes that I'm not going to drink anymore. And sometimes later that day I was drinking. I never understood what was going on there. And then the mental obsession was explained to me. And then the spiritual malady was explained to me. And they didn't have to talk about that much, because I knew exactly what they were talking about, because I was experiencing all that craziness now, 3.5 years sober. And I could see it when I was drinking. But especially now, I'm totally feeling it. I can't escape it. It's And I know for a fact that there's enough people here tonight that more than a few of you know exactly what I'm talking about right now in your life. And I'm here to tell you that it doesn't have to be that way. You're suffering from untreated alcoholism, and it doesn't matter how long it's been since your last drink, you're closer to your next drink than you realize, because alcohol is going to help you with that craziness. But it doesn't have to be that way, because we have a program that deals with that stuff so much more than deals with it. You know, 1.5 years ago, I had lost a job. I was working for AT&T, and then my department spilled over to Lucent Technologies, and then that the same department spilled over to Avaya Communication, and then they decided to announce layoffs, and I got laid off. I had that job for about 16 or 17 years. It was one of those jobs where, you know, when you joined AT&T back then, you basically had a job for the rest of your life. So I thought I was basically taken care of, and I lost my job. Now, that was a year and a half ago. My sobriety date is June 3rd, 1991. I have worked and reworked the steps a few times, and now I'm presented with an extreme life situation, let's call it, okay? Now, what was interesting was that they announced the layoffs, and it wasn't really that big of a deal for me. But that night I went to sleep, and when I woke up, the beast was on me. When I woke up, I had that fear. When I woke up, I had that you know what I'm talking about. Like when you know what I mean? Like it's been there since you've been sleeping, and it's just waiting for you to wake up so we can tell you, you know what I mean? You know what I mean? Like, you know what I mean? You're not enough. You're never going to find another job. You're a loser. You know what I mean? And it was just on me, and it's funny because I woke up and I like sat up because I hadn't heard that thing in years. I hadn't heard that thing on me first thing in the morning in years. And I started crying because I was like, I remember what it was like now. That was how I spent every day that voice was on me from the moment that I woke up to the moment I went to sleep and even while I was sleeping. And this thing was on me, and I started praying and meditating, and in a few hours it was gone, and I went through my day. And the next day, it was there again when I first woke up, and I prayed and meditated, and it was only there for like maybe an hour, and now it's never returned. And I don't know about you, but that's a miracle. That's a miracle to be living my life that way nonstop for 30-something years, and then you experience a program, you experience conscious contact, you experience working with people, you experience stuff that doesn't seem like it's going to have anything to do with dealing with that inside stuff. And for one day, I had fear over an extreme life event, and then it was gone. And I don't know about you, but that's the single greatest experience I've ever had in my life, besides direct conscious contact with spiritual experiences and stuff like that, meditative experiences, incredible experiences with working with people and seeing their eyes light up. But for me, it's so, the whole not drinking thing is such the smallest part of the whole deal. It's unbelievable. With the depth of the 12 steps, I'm not kidding when I say that I believe that the depth of the spirituality in the 12 steps should be up there with Christianity, Judaism, and Buddhism. If they ever have like a gathering, they should include the spirituality of the 12 steps, because there is so much there, and there is so much in this book that you can go deeper and deeper. No matter how far you've gone, no matter how wonderful your life is today, as the result of this process, you can go even way beyond that. There is nobody that's experienced the fullness of the spirituality of the 12 steps. And that's the message that I have to carry. Alcoholism when I was out there drinking. Untreated alcoholism. 3.5 years suffering here in AA. And now, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, I try to carry this message, and I try to practice these principles in all my affairs. You know, it's interesting. This past weekend, we did a big book study over in Pennsylvania, and there were probably about 40 people there. And after we were done, this gentleman walked up to me, and he said, you know, I've never heard you guys before, but I've gone to many of these big book studies, and I think I can't imagine it being any better than how this weekend went. And I looked at him, and I said, that's only because of one reason, and that's because you allowed God to appear here. You experienced the presence of a group of people that were willing to consider new information and that were willing to consider and listen to some experience of people who have done this work. This doesn't have anything to do with us. This has to do with you directly being open-minded and being present as we went through this weekend. And we talked a little bit, and he kind of saw what I was talking about. And one thing that I truly believe is that God did me a favor by giving me alcoholism. I remember a few months ago, which time do I have? I remember a couple months ago, a friend of mine was doing a workshop, and this woman stood up, and she said, you know, I'm pissed at God, because why is it that I have alcoholism? Nobody else in my family has alcoholism. And the guy kind of handled that as best that he could. And I remember thinking and going over to the woman after the meeting was over, and I said to her, you know, there's really no reason for you to be pissed at God about the fact that you have alcoholism, because The reason why you have it and nobody else in your family has it is because you're the lucky one. You have a disease where you, if you take the cure, if you take the program, you'll end up being a better person, and that will affect all the people around you, including your family. So right now you might see it as a curse, but you're actually the lucky one. And then I walked away from her, and I hope that she got that message, because I truly do believe that. Each one of us here is the lucky one. Because perhaps right now some of us may be blocked, but if we consider another way besides our own and try to practice these principles and work this program, it's a life that's beyond our wildest dreams. Thank you.